Week 14 is getting underway. We're talking Matthew Stafford and why he's our pick for NFL MVP. We'll have a deep dive breakdown of the games we're most excited about, lots of listener mail, and our oh-so-very bold predictions for Sunday's games. All that on the MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast. Hey, it's Gary Gramling from the 10 Things podcast here, and I want to tell you about our friends at Mack Weldon. I'm wearing some of their sweats right now as I do today's show, and I don't mean to brag, but I can promise you what I'm wearing is better than whatever you're wearing right now. Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. I mean, it could not be easier. If you have some non-tech-savvy folks in your family, grandparents, parents, send them to MackWeldon.com because it's online shopping done easy. Anyone can figure it out. And like I said, the stuff I have on looks great and feels great. Mack Weldon has the most comfortable underwear, socks, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants that you will ever wear. All of their products are naturally antimicrobial, which means they eliminate odor. You can wear it all day, wear it to the gym, wear it while you sit around watching football, and then wear it out on a date. You'll look good, you'll smell good. What else could you possibly want? This might be the best part, though. Mack Weldon wants you to be comfortable, so much so that if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it and they will still refund you. No questions asked. So go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off using the promo code MMQB. That's MackWeldon.com. Use the promo code MMQB.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things Podcast NFL Look Ahead Edition. We are coming up on Week 14, playoff stretch. It's going to be some good stuff. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit, and we are going to do a little bit of deep diving into some of the week's best games. Andy, you ready to get this thing going?
I am, and I think we are beginning with what I'm going to try to push into an MVP discussion. Is that correct?
We'll see where the discussion takes us, because we are going to talk about Matthew Stafford. And I'll just say, I was on the Stafford MVP bandwagon early. I got my tickets, and I lined up overnight, like I was waiting for an iPhone, and I got on that thing early on. He, you know, I think early in the season, everyone was kind of saying, well, the Lions will fall off. Lions will end up 8-8, maybe 9-7. They'll miss the playoffs again. And I think that's why everyone sort of disqualified him. And when you look at the roster, it's not a great team. But Stafford has certainly carried them through this season. Even last week, you know, no Marvin Jones. And he's got TJ Jones going out there. And he's throwing to Andre Roberts. And Golden Tate, who was not playing well at all early in the year, but has come on lately. What has it been with Stafford this season, Andy?
Well, you listed a bunch of factors around him, and you're right. He's got a young offensive line as well, and there's been instability in the backfield a little bit. And the one constant in that offense for Detroit, for the most part, has been Stafford. And he has taken the system that Jim Bob Cooter has him in. Encourages more of a cautious approach to the game. It doesn't demand it, but it naturally propagates it. And I think there's a lot more chances for a rhythmic approach. You look at the number of throws they have that go to Riddick out of the backfield, or especially mm-hmm. Tate on misdirection stuff. Those are defined reads. They get the ball out, you know, ball in the quarterback's hand, balls out. There's a timing element to all of it. And I think that helps a quarterback naturally be disciplined, kind of similar to what we saw with Jay Cutler under Adam Gase last season.
Yeah.
So the system has instilled some discipline on Stafford. To his credit, he has embraced that and actually run with it very well, and actually run with it quite literally, because that's the other factor with him, is his legs have now become a big plus, not just as a scrambler and not just out of the pocket. He does that extremely well now, but also within the pocket, he's a much better pocket mover. So we're talking about the fundamental elements of quarterbacking, and that's always been the concern with Stafford, because mm-hmm. the wow factor is always off the charts, and the arm strength and the arm angles, he can make any throw from any platform, he hasn't lost that part of his game either. So he's gotten better in the areas that he needed to improve in. I do think he is, if we're going to remove Brady from the discussion because of the four-game suspension, then I think Stafford is the NFL MVP this year.
Yeah. You know, I love how we talk about Stafford and Brady, the legs. No one talks about the legs and you know, their movement within the pocket and the way they can sort of extend some of these plays, it's making a huge difference for both of these guys. Now, obviously the huge difference with Detroit this year, no Calvin Johnson. And you figure naturally, Marvin Jones is not Calvin Johnson and Golden Tate is not Calvin Johnson. You lose Calvin Johnson, you figure you're going to get worse. I mean, is it just is it a matter of the lack of sort of a superstar receiver playing into Cooter's system even more?
I don't know if it's that quite so much. It's hard, that's a hard one to reconcile because we all agree Calvin Johnson was an exceptional player. And I've never played quarterback, so I tread lightly here because I'm almost diving into psychological stuff. But I think Stafford, there are certain types of quarterbacks that maybe having those big, rangy targets, it's like a moth to the flame for them. It's not necessarily a good thing. It's a double-edged sword. And Calvin Johnson, in a way, having him on the field encouraged Stafford to play with the lack of discipline that was always his issue, always his problem. Go back to Cutler as another example again. I don't know if having Alshon Jeffrey and Brandon Marshall for all those years was the best thing for Cutler. Mm-hmm. So it's these wild stallion QBs with the big arms who take chances and are fundamentally inconsistent, which is what Stafford was for up until this about a year ago. He's been this way for about a year and a half now. I don't know if having a Calvin Johnson type receiver is the best thing for him. I think, again, it goes back to discipline has been instilled upon Stafford around him, and then he's fully embraced that. He's had to be more disciplined because he doesn't have receivers who can win on their own. He has to let the scheme take care of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, Stafford has now played 21 games under Jim Bob Cooter as his offensive coordinator. And, you know, a lot of people discount that first game. They went out to London. Short week. Cooter had been promoted that week. They got blown out by the Chiefs in London, and then they had the bye week, and then they really turned it on after that. I will count that Chiefs game because, you know, why have an even more arbitrary starting point here? But, yeah, Stafford's numbers, 41 touchdowns, 9 interceptions, and if you're a QB wins guy, and let's face it, the Lions aren't, it's not the kind of defense that's going to carry this. They don't have the Denver Broncos defense on either side of the ball or anything. But this team's 14-7 in those games. And look, they've won, 7 of 8 at this point. And I guess last thing I'd ask you, Andy, do you think the Lions hang on with that 2-game lead in the NFC North, or do you think they still turn into a pumpkin late in the year?
Well, I think the responsible prediction is to say they will hang on because their best game of the season may have been their last one against the New Orleans Saints.
Yeah.
And just probably for the simple fact that they didn't have a fourth quarter comeback involved. And that's why, by the way, I put Stafford over the top for MVP because those fourth quarter comebacks, he does have to turn back and not the pumpkin, but I'll call him the wild stallion. At times, he does have to become that again and force the issue. And we saw that at the end of the first Vikings game was the best example where he had to step up and make some big time throws deep at the deep intermediate levels, and he's been able to do that. I would place my money on the Lions if I were a betting man at this point for the NFC North.
Yeah, it's they get the Bears this week, and then a tough little finishing flourish here. They have to go to New York Giants at Dallas, and then they get the Packers at home in Week 17, which might have a whole lot of meaning to it.
All three of those games are going to have meaning to them.
Yep. Well, let's talk about a couple games that have meaning this week, and, well, none of them are going to be that Lions-Bears game. Let's jump into our favorite games of Week 14, and we're going to start with Ravens at Patriots, Monday night, a Monday nighter worth watching. This is
finally
a makeup for last week's Colts-Jets game, which I watch most of, unfortunately. I don't know why.
I did, too. I was disappointed when who was it that Doyle fumbled into the end zone? Because I thought, oh, good, they're going to go up huge, and we might be able to get out of here midway through the third quarter. Because it was late for me. I'd started it very late. So I got to sit there and root for that one. It's not fun rooting when you watch these games.
It was one to forget. But this one's going to be really good. And, you know, Andy, I know you wanted to talk about this one because all you've been talking about is that Ravens front seven, particularly Michael Pierce and Brandon Williams, in the middle of that defensive line and the things they are doing to opposing running games. You're talking about it nonstop. You're calling people at 3 a.m. talking about the new Williams wall. But it looks
those
like
guys
the Patriots
have been tremendous. Those guys have been absolutely
they
tremendous.
Haven't. But you figure the Patriots in this one, they're probably going to try and spread the Ravens out and do that thing. You know, the Patriots have the sort of the two distinct ways they can go with this offense, and this figures to be a week where they're going to spread things out.
Yeah, because they are willing to just totally ignore the running game when they go up against a really dominant run defense. We saw them do that actually last time, or at least in 2014 when they played the Ravens in the divisional round, they did that. We saw them do that at times against the Jets last season and a little bit earlier this year as well. I think they'll do that in this one. I don't think they're going to try to smash mouth their way between the tackles against Baltimore, although New England has been doing that more often than I think a lot of people would guess lately. James Devlin at fullback's been a factor for him. LeGarrette Blount's a good gap scheme runner when there are pull blockers. But I don't think that's the right formula here. And New England is so good in their quick strike passing game that really, in their minds, that's just an extension of the run game anyway. They feel like those 3 and 4 yard completions with the run after the catch, those are not the riskiest of throws for them. So I'm eager to see how this plays out, Gary, because the other thing besides the run defense that has stood out with Baltimore is how well they play in underneath zone coverage. They do a lot of cover two and cover three. Cover two's been their big one. And C.J. Mosley in particular, but also Zach Gore and also Webb and Weddle at safety, whichever one of them is rotating down at the time. Those guys have all played with tremendous spatial reasoning in zone coverage, and now they get the ultimate test with the Patriots.
Well, what do they do? I was going to say, you know, the Patriots sort of, they invert things. You know, they'll send Martellus Bennett out wide. They'll send Deion Lewis out wide. How do the Ravens counter that? Do you send your linebackers out there with those guys, and then you just have, you know, your corners kicking inside to deal with Edelman and Amendola and Hogan or whoever else might line up inside?
Well, the risk you run with that is if the Patriots were to shift Deion Lewis back into the backfield like that, then you've got your cornerbacks stuck at the linebacker position. And the Ravens actually got in that scenario in their last game, and Jerrod Powers was at linebacker, and he got absolutely run over on the play. So I think you roll with it and play Mosley and Orr and zone coverage like they've been doing all season. Those guys can be very physical. You can jam them receivers under 5 yards. I think that's how you try to do this if you're Baltimore. I don't think you try to match up in man coverages. They haven't played a lot of man coverage this season. New England's very good tactically against it anyway. Mm-hmm. The Patriots are going to force you to back off. You're not going to get the Patriots stuck at the line of scrimmage. Very few teams have done that. Only Denver has really done that in the last 2 years, in fact. So it's a matter of executing fundamentals after they get off the line of scrimmage. And I think we're going to see a lot of 8-man coverages, in fact, too. Maybe drop one of those defensive linemen back in the shallow crossing lanes. Teams like to do that against Brady as well.
Interesting. Now, the Ravens always give the Patriots a run here, even in years where you'd look at the two rosters and say, you know, they can't stack up. But, you know, it seems like Baltimore is really coming on of late. Joe Flacco had a monster game in that easy win over the Dolphins last week. I want to talk about Flacco versus this Patriots D, though, because the Patriots, you know, they've been sort of a bend-don't-break type of D. But especially the last 3 weeks, you know, they got ripped up by Russell Wilson. And then the last 3 weeks, they just really haven't had to be a great defense. They've had, you know, they went to San Francisco. They went and faced Fitzpatrick and the Jets. And then they just hosted Jared Goff and whatever those five guys who stand in front of Jared Goff do, which is usually not block. So I don't know. Can the Ravens sort of keep pace with a Brady offense in this matchup?
I think so. I'll be interested to see, because when Flacco gets hot, and this is what happened last week, a lot of times he gets hot against zone coverage, and he gets in a great timing and rhythm element there. And zone coverage, that's how it's built, especially very vanilla zone coverages, which is what Miami got caught playing in the first half last week. When he knows where the defenders will be, that's when he slices you and dices you between the field numbers. Mm-hmm. So he's very good there. New England's not going to play a lot of zone, though. I would imagine they will man up. That's how they have played often. They might go cover three on early downs, but for the most part, they're going to be a man-to-man defense and be a matchup-oriented defense, and that changes the timing a little bit. So Flacco will have to inherently play a little less on schedule or more off schedule, and we'll see where that goes. When you get like that, then your pocket fundamentals and mechanics become a bigger factor as the play goes on in that nature, and that's where Flacco's been uneven this season. So this will be a revealing game for him and those Ravens receivers, because those guys are playing better too. Perryman's playing better. Mike Wallace, a little more diverse in what he's doing with his route tree. Aikens made some plays lately. Can they step up against a really quality man-to-man team across the board?
Kenneth Dixon. Can Kenneth Dixon take a little bit of advantage of a Jamie Collins-less Patriots defense? Because it seems like Collins is the type of guy who would, he'd probably run with Pitta in this game, but you get one more receiving threat out of the backfield who the Ravens sort of didn't have early in the year.
Yeah, it's always tough to know who New England's going to put on the running back and tight end because they have a lot of options there. They're athletic at the safety position, specifically with Patrick Chung. Mm-hmm. And against certain running backs like your Shane Vereen types, they'll put Chung on that guy. Usually, though, he takes the tight end. There are times where he takes the slot, though. It's hard to know who's going to guard who in New England. In fact, it's to such an extent that you sometimes don't even know which guys are going to play at which positions. So they're going to be very matchup-oriented, and that's what I always like to see is when you put on the film early in the game, who did New England put on which receivers? Because that usually tells you how they feel about those opposing receivers. And I, to answer your question, Gary, I don't know. I can't guess at that one. Kyle Van Noy's been a covered guy a little bit more lately, but I don't know how well he would do in man coverage against a guy like Dixon. It'll be interesting to see how that goes. Keep in mind, though, Baltimore also is going to keep those running backs in to pass protect more often than not. So those guys tend to be check down guys anyway, which would probably influence who Belichick and Matt Patricia decide to put on the running back.
All right, well, let's move on. Let's actually move back a night and look at the Sunday nighter. Dallas at the New York Giants. Of course, the Giants, the only team to beat the 2016 Dallas Cowboys. Now, Giants come to this one. No Jason Pierre-Paul. He's out for the year with the hernia surgery. It's a different Cowboys offense than the Giants saw early on in the year. They have gotten a little more bold with Dak Prescott. And, the offensive line, the running game is clicking as well as it possibly could be. I don't know, Andy. Are you expecting to see more of the same from this Dallas offense now that they're getting a second crack at a shorthanded Giants D?
I think Dallas's offense is at such a level, at least in that zone running game, where you have to assume they will play well. I mean, it's an aberration when they don't, or it's the anomaly when they don't. But they did not in that week one against the Giants, and their chemistry hadn't quite clicked at that point. Their timing was off. That continued into the week two game against Washington. They've since gotten on track. But, Gary, it's not an easy front four, even without Jason Pierre-Paul, and he is a big loss for them. In the run game especially, but it's still not an easy front four to play against because they're so good at tackle. Really, it's Damon Harrison's the X factor because in Dallas's scheme, it's Travis Frederick's block is almost always the most important block and whether he can reach and seal the nose tackle. And there aren't a lot of teams this year that have successfully had reach and seal blocks over the course of a game again and again on Damon Harrison. So that'll be the X factor. The other thing with the Giants and what stands out more now than it did back in week one is how good Landon Collins has been as an insert player into the box. And a lot of times he's the unblocked guy by design. The offense can't account for everybody. He's that eighth defender. He's really flourished in that role. And even when he's been part of the structure and part of the guys who do get blocked, he's looked good as well there. So it's a better Giants run defense than the Cowboys saw in week one too.
You know, the Giants had their hands full of Le'Veon Bell last week, but the plays that kind of turned that game were a couple big plays in the passing game, which they haven't been giving up as much this year. And again, we talked a little about the Giants on the Monday show and how how much of a mirage was that stretch they went through where they just didn't face a whole lot of great opponents. But Landon Collins was a guy who got beat a couple times on Sunday. He was a big liability in coverage as a rookie a year ago. Was Sunday's performance in Pittsburgh, was that at all concerning to you? Was that just an aberration?
Well, I wouldn't call it an aberration, because what you said about Collins, yeah, we've both been on that same page for a while now. He is a better better attack-oriented pass defender than reactionary pass defender. So if you have him caught in man coverage where he has to react to everything the guy he's guarding, where he has to react to those guys, he becomes vulnerable. And if you have him read certain route combinations, he becomes vulnerable. So he has to be, the freer he is, the better he is, which is probably true with a lot of guys, but especially with him. So he did blow the coverage. He played the right coverage. He just jumped the route incorrectly on Ladarius Green's touchdown in the second half there. That was really the only play that was glaring to me, though. In fact, watching that whole game, Gary, I thought the Giants overall in pass defense on the back end, I thought they thoroughly outplayed the Steelers. You had the Antonio Brown touchdown was a great offensive play. Janoris Jenkins had the coverage. Roethlisberger extended the play. The Ladarius Green 37-yard catch earlier in the game, that was just the way – that was another coverage breakdown due to Roethlisberger extending the play. So it's the pass rush that remains the concern with the Giants. This secondary right now, and especially the cornerbacks, they're playing as well as about any secondary in the NFL.
Thoroughly, I take exception to.
Well, I think within the context of the play designs, I think they thoroughly outplayed the Steelers. Now, what happened was the play designs – when they get extended, then you still have to keep playing. And you're right, the Steelers were the ones that made more plays in that case. But I think if I'm a coach, if I'm Steve Spagnuolo, and we're looking at the film on Monday morning or Tuesday morning or whenever they did that, I'm not barking at my guys over anything other than the Landon Collins play, and he knows he messed that up. They did everything within the design of the scheme really well, and more often than not, that's going to be enough. Now, it'll be interesting in this game. Prescott's another guy who can extend plays. He's not Roethlisberger in that regard, but we know what he can do moving around. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes, because the Giants' pass rush, there's no reason to believe it's going to get home at all against the Cowboys' offensive line and against Dak Prescott.
Yep. Well, Andy, anything else you want to touch on in regards to the Sunday nighter?
I guess just the other thing, I mentioned the corners a little bit a second ago. Janoris Jenkins will probably travel with Dez Bryant whenever possible, which is what Jenkins has been doing against number one receivers lately, and he's done it very well. And then I think Eli Apple's playing at a very high level, especially in regard to where he was at when the Cowboys first saw him, or very early in the season. He has gotten very sharp on the perimeter. And the other guy, Rogers Cromartie, has transitioned into a good slot defender, even in zone coverage, which not a lot of cover corners are able to do. So that's been impressive. So they've got three corners who thrive in man coverage and zone coverage, and that's important because Steve Spagnuolo changes up his coverage calls probably more than any coordinator in the league throughout a game.
All right. Well, let's move it on. We're going to touch on one more here, and this is the Saints at Bucks. Like we said on Monday's show, we were shortchanging the Bucks just a little bit. But let's dive into what they're doing here. Because when you look at what the Saints struggled with last week against Detroit, and you look at what the Bucks are doing so well on the back end of their defense, you figure you really got to like this matchup.
You like
Bucks
it on Tampa's
perspective, I should say.
Right. I was going to say, you like it on Tampa's perspective because what they have done so well the last few weeks, and especially last week, is their chemistry in zone coverage has gotten very good. They pass off assignments and rotate and have the spatial reasoning. They're as good. They're tremendous right now in that regard. And Vernon Hargreaves is another young cornerback who's really risen up and gotten better in the second half of his rookie season. He's been a big player for them. So that's important because that's where Detroit thrived against New Orleans as well. Detroit was very disciplined, especially in the second half last week in their zone assignments against Drew Brees and the Saints.
And I'd ask this on the other side of the ball. You know, we've talked about our love of chip blocks and the Bucs' emphasis on chip blocks to keep Jameis Winston clean and comfortable in the pocket. It's a Saints defense that you don't necessarily have to be freaking out about as far as the guys coming off the edge. You know, Cameron Jordan is a good player. Wait, is it Cameron Jordan or Jordan Cameron? Cameron Jordan. I got it right the first time.
Cameron Jordan. Yep. And everybody has to do that every time. His own coaches have probably done that. His own coaches have done that for years, I bet.
Exactly. But other than that, I mean, it's not a team you really have to devote great resources to. So can the Bucks open things up just a little bit more this week?
Yeah, they can, because you're right. The Saints do not have, and as good of a player as Cameron Jordan is, he's not an edge burner. He's a technician. He's a strong man. But that's not a type of guy you have to slide your protections to necessarily. And if you chip block him, he's not an edge guy. So the chip blocks could, in theory, be counterproductive anyway, because he does so much working inside or right up against an offensive tackle as opposed to trying to get around the corner. The thing about the chips, and they did it less last week, Tampa did in their win last week against San Diego. The thing about those is that it fits their system naturally anyway. It's a longer passing system, yeah. Vertical. Deeper yep. dropbacks, so they have time to chip block. So a lot of times that's just built into how they play. But they're going to be protection first. And last week against the Chargers, that was six-man protections. I would think they'll do that against the Saints. I don't think they need to go as cautious as they did against Seattle a few weeks ago.
Okay. Anything else you want to jump on from this game, Andy?
No, it's a Saints defense that I think has – once again, probably disappointed some people. And maybe at some point we want to look closer at that, because this is a team that's, when they traded Jimmy Graham, it was under the conditions of we're going to build the defense, we're going to get better on the other side of the ball. And I understand that stuff takes some time, but they really haven't, it hasn't come to fruition yet for a variety of reasons. And it's they're doing what they can. They're rotating players. They're calling a lot of blitzes the last several weeks, especially off of the edge, which I would think they'll do in this game, because teams like to blitz Jameis Winston. It rushes him. It gets his mechanical glitches tend to show up a little more in that case. He'll take some chances. But they're having to really scheme their way through stuff. It's not a defense right now that's good enough to just line up and play against people.
Well, Stephon Anthony, one of the guys they got – he was one of their first-round pick they picked up in the Jimmy Graham trade. I mean, he's not even on the field anymore. And the one thing I'd ask you is, you know, these Dennis Allen defenses, they are multiple and they have a reputation for being very complex. Is it simply a matter of we all had to recognize there was going to be a steeper learning curve, or is this getting to the point where, you know, this is too steep? This is they should have a grasp on this thing at this point.
Well, they're not going crazy like that. They're not like what the Raiders were a few years ago, yeah, under Allen, where there was a lot of stuff and it took 10 hours to watch their film to try to figure out what they were doing. They changed things up, but it's a little more basic, although they did do a tremendous job with disguises against Detroit last week. So what you're saying is not like it's not inaccurate. It's an element of both factors there. Allen doesn't like Anthony. I think we can surmise that. I don't know what the reason for that is. Anthony got better late last season, and that was under Dennis Allen, or at least he did midway through the season. Something has gone on there, though, and he's soured on the guy, and it didn't help that he gave up the touchdown to Theo Riddick in the slot last week, the one-yard mm-hmm. touchdown. So, yeah, it's strange, and what they need to decide, something has to set still here. Either the roster has to set still and you find the coach that plays to this roster, or they need to really dock up to Dennis Allen and say, okay, he's the young coach we have here. He's a former head coach. He's going to run our defense like a head coach, so to speak. And now let's let him help Mickey Loomis in this front office build the roster that he wants. Right now, coach and player have not matched up enough in New Orleans. There have been too many moving pieces over the years.
Which makes a little bit of sense. Rob Ryan was still there when they, you know, when they had that plethora of picks back in 2015. Allen, you know, he took over in what, mid-2015, so they've only had one draft with him as defensive coordinator.
Yep.
But Andy, I think it's that time where we open up the stacks and stacks of letters from the mailbag.
The 10 Things Mailbag starts now.
If you want to send a question to the MMQB 10 Things podcast, you can send it to Andy_Benoit or ggramling_si on Twitter. You can also write in to talkback@themmqb.com, or you can hit us up on Facebook. We are both on there. Just search for our names, and you should be able to find us. We have the blue check marks. Very easy to find. All right, this first question is coming from Twitter. This is Rodrigo at R. Quintanar. Do you see Seattle using more cover one or cover three due to the Earl Thomas injury? And what AFC teams could benefit from this? I'll say what NFC teams can benefit from that. Basically, who facing the Seahawks potentially in a playoff scenario would benefit from facing a different system? But I'll put it out there first, Andy. What are they going to do? Are they going to stick with the cover three or change up some things with Earl Thomas out?
Well, that's a good question, and it's so. What Rodrigo, was that what you said the gentleman's
yes.
name was?
Yep.
What cover one is, what he means by that is man free, so man to man with a free safety. Which cover three is zone with a free safety. So it's similar for the safety, except that if you're in zone, you're going to be reading the routes differently versus if you're in man to man, especially when you're back deep. And so if they wanted to hide Stephen Terrell. And I don't know if they do. He's been in there for a little while now. I think they're comfortable with him in the scheme in their cover three. But if they wanted to hide and help him, they would play more man-to-man coverage. And that's something they've actually done quite a bit this season. Not as much the last few weeks, but for probably the first 10 weeks of the year, they played a lot more man coverage, especially on third downs there. And Earl Thomas was a big part of that. So maybe they play less now because he's not there. I don't know what they play, but I will tell you this, Gary. One coach, an NFC coach, told me, and he played Seattle, he said, when you play against them as an offensive coach, he said, you're in the back of your mind, you're just praying for snaps where they go out of their cover three and play something else, because
yeah.
that's when you feel like you've got your chance.
I'm not Chris Richard, but if I were, I think I'd just stick with the cover three. You know, make sure the rest of the secondary is comfortable with what they're doing and let them do what they do well, and you know, you're going to have to deal with that downgrade at the one safety spot, but no reason to spread that around the rest of the secondary.
Right, and you could augment the instability at that position by starting to change things up too much to hide it and account for it. Part of the benefit
yep.
of having so much talent is that you can survive when little pieces, and not that Earl Thomas is a little piece, but proportionately he kind of is. They have about 8 Earl Thomases on that defense. You can survive when one goes away. The other guys are still so talented.
Do you still consider Seattle to be the best team in the NFC?
Yes, absolutely the most. Maybe not the best. I mean, Dallas probably deserves that kind of respect because at the end of it, this winning and losing
stuff
doesn't matter.
I should say, you know, the old if they played a tournament on a neutral field at this
Seattle.
Point.
Seattle. That's
okay.
the team I would not want to play.
Okay.
What
right,
about
next
you?
Question.
I mean, do you see them differently? I think they're that dangerous because I think their offense is starting to catch up to their defense talent-wise.
Yeah, I mean, look, the only thing I think of is back to the Atlanta loss where, oh no, I'm sorry, they won that game in Atlanta, but they sort of played it like
it lost. It felt like a loss. It was weird.
And that sort of borderline meltdown, you know, Richard Sherman's going nuts on the sideline, and you know, you don't want to put too much stock into that. That sort of drama just happens sometimes, but, you know, Earl Thomas was in that game, and can you imagine if Earl Thomas did not play in that game and those things were going down? So I guess it just sort of opens it up a little bit, but
it'll matter who matches up to him because what was so interesting about that Falcons game was the Falcons are coached by Dan Quinn, who knows that Seahawks defense intimately
yeah.
and actually runs the same thing. So they knew exactly what Seattle did not want to see, and they did a lot of pre-snap shifting to take advantage of that. They really distorted Seattle's zone coverages and especially the zone looks before the snap. So, yeah, there is a blueprint, so to speak, out there. What nullifies that kind of stuff is if Seattle's pass rush is healthy, and it's healthy now. Averill's in there. Bennett's back. Frank Clark's playing at an extremely high level.
Mm-hmm.
The pass rush can still nullify when the offensive scheme wins.
Yeah, Michael Bennett is coming back. Or he is back, I should say, after missing a chunk of time there. And I know how much you love looking forward in these playoff projections, but the Falcons won the NFC South and won a home playoff game. They'd go out to Seattle, in all likelihood, as a 3 seed.
In the second round, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that is quite a far look ahead there, my friend. That is,
it is.
You've given a division
also, Detroit
title
would
to
have
a team
to drop
that's tied
a game
it?
Or two
yeah.
from here on in. But just something to think about. you won't think about it. That's really not anything to think about. It's just something I said. But let's jump on to the next question. This is coming from TalkBack. Again, you can send questions to the TalkBack to TalkBack at themmqb.com if you are not on Twitter or Facebook or anything, which is just very strange in this day and age. But this is coming from Nathan Egbayemi. Can Ladarius Green become a real third option threat for Pittsburgh? Andy, I'll let you jump on that one, and then I'll weigh in with a thought of mine.
He made a number of third down plays against the Giants, and some of those were contested catches, and I think he can become a threat because he brings a vertical dimension to the seams, seam routes, patterns over the middle of the field. So, yes, to answer that question, I'm very curious to see what this offense becomes with him now because he's been a big factor these last 2 weeks.
Yeah. No, he's so much more dynamic than Jesse James. Yeah, I think he is a difference maker down the stretch for this team, especially with, you know, you don't know what you're going to get out of Sammy Coates. I mean, they've been running Kobe Hamilton out there, who is not nearly the same talent as Coates or Martavis Bryant. I think Green is coming on at just the right time. And look, when they signed him, this is what they had in mind for him.
Yep. And when you have a tight end that factors in, then that also opens up your running back checkdown game a little bit too. And Le'Veon Bell was able to take advantage of that a few times against the Giants.
And by the way, I think I slandered Ladarius Green back when we were doing our tight end show during the offseason. But, you know, long ago during the San Diego days, this was probably 2 years ago now, there was a lot of buzz about how he does not play hurt. When he is hurt, he likes to sit. He does not like to go out and play. So there's something to be said for him coming on mid-season and not being as banged up as he normally might be had he played 12 games at this point.
Yeah, interesting point.
We will jump on to the next one here. This is coming from Trevor Magruder. If Aldon Smith is reinstated anytime soon, what does he bring to the Raiders' defense going forward? I don't know at this point. He's been gone for so long. I would imagine you don't get the same guy that he was when he left more than a year ago now.
Well, when they inserted him into the lineup last time, they changed the defense for him. They went and became a 3-4 defense that very week in order to get Smith and Khalil Mack both on the field together. Alden Smith has long arms, violent hands, and good flexibility. So you put that in any equation, and let's say he's getting 20 snaps a game, that will be a factor. They don't need him badly, though. Bruce Irvin's playing at a very high level as well, and he's shown that he can handle playing 80% of the snaps.
All right. Coming from Jacob Jones here, the DeQuell Jackson suspension, how much does it hurt the Colts' playoff chances? The Colts, of course, are now tied atop the AFC South with those two other teams, the Texans and the Titans.
Jackson's not a great player, but he is the closest thing they've had to a stabilizing presence in the middle of that defense. And now they have Edwin Jackson. Josh McNary will probably get more snaps. I think Antonio Morrison, if they're fourth-round rookies in the equation, if I'm not mistaken. They've been rotating a lot at that position, that inside linebacker, which is not a good sign. It's not a position you want to have to rotate at necessarily. And the other thing to keep in mind is, as Gethers is out, their backup safety, he's their dime guy. In order to nullify some of the issues they have at inside linebacker, they play dime and have Gethers basically play as one of those linebackers. So until he's back in the lineup, that's a hamstrung defense schematically right up the middle.
And I was going to say, does Jackson, he handles the calls for them, doesn't he?
I think he does. I would be surprised if someone else did.
Yeah, I would wonder if there will be some issues with that. That's never a good thing. But I guess it's good to lose him before a game than mid-game. And last question here coming from Xavier Peters. This is one I am very curious about, Andy, and I will actually ask it and then get out of the way. How come Greg Robinson has been such a bust? Was it poor scouting, poor coaching, lack of development, all of the above? I'll just chime in real quick. When he was coming out of Auburn, he was, of course, incredibly raw, and he was considered something of one of those freak athlete project type of guys who was, you know, when you go number two overall, you're expected to be closer than not. But I was wondering how he'd translate if they just made him a guard full time. And I don't know what you do with him at this point.
I think you do move him to guard if you have him back. His contract's going to be expiring here soon. Yeah. It's 2014, so he's probably got another year after this one. But they're going to have some decisions to make. I would try him out at guard, which they've already had to do that with Roger Saffold, another guy, a relatively high pick from many years before Robinson. He's a liability in pass protection. And the thing I didn't like about the pick from the beginning, because a guy like that, he's built to be a mauler. And when you're a run-blocking mauler, you're the aggressor. When you put those athletic freaks like that in pass protection, they have to still be the reactors. So it almost doesn't matter how big they are, because they have to react to the smaller defensive ends and block them, and that's what he does not do well. Fundamentally, he's been very stiff in that way. So what I didn't like about the pick, though, was that you had this mauling type of offensive lineman, and then you had drafted Tavon Austin in the first round the year before, and those two styles of play do not mesh, and we're seeing that now. Austin is a spread system guy, a gadget player, a wide open offense is where he fits. And then Robinson's someone you put in for a pounding offense, a smash mouth running offense, and we're seeing Austin really not be a big factor because that's how the Rams are trying to play now. They're trying to be a smash mouth offense. So I thought those two picks back to back years, there was too much discrepancy between the style of player they went after.
Yep. Well, they have quite a decision to make with his fifth-year option next year. I can't imagine that they'd exercise it, but who knows? Who knows what the offseason will bring? Andy, we are on to the last part of our show, and your least favorite part of probably any show or anything anywhere, and I'm going to call it bold predictions for branding purposes, but I will tell you, I will reiterate, you can just tell us something we maybe do not know about Week 14's matchups. Is that all right?
Okay, that's okay. Fine. But you're going to do it. You're going to start off with a bold prediction, right?
I will give my bold prediction, and that is that the Bucs are going to beat the Saints, and the Rams are going to upset the Falcons at home because this is such a Jeff Fisher game to win, where everyone's written them off, and they just sort of pulled this out of nowhere. I think Jared Goff has a bit of a coming out party, and the Rams win that one, and the Bucks are all alone in first place in the NFC South at the end of Week 14.
All right, very good. I'm going to say that a big mismatch in a matchup this weekend is Miami's defensive line against Arizona's offensive line, specifically up the middle, inside. Arizona's had to move guys around on the right side, and A.Q. Shipley's been okay at center, but he's had instability at guard around him. Mike Iupati's actually probably been a below-average guard this season. He has not played well. That's a problem when you go up against Ndamukong Suh, Jordan Phillips, and Earl Mitchell. And those last two guys, they're going to get overshadowed by Sue, but coaches are not going to think differently. The coaches see three big-time star defensive tackles when they get ready to play the Dolphins. That's a concern to me. So my bold prediction is Dolphins defensive tackles eat the Cardinals' interior offensive line alive.
That is bold. I will accept that as your bold prediction. And Andy, that's going to be it for our show. As always, you guys can catch us on Monday mornings with our 10 Things podcast, the normal 10 Things podcast, the traditional 10 Things podcast. But that's going to do it for this one. Thanks to our sponsor, Mack Weldon. Again, great-looking, great-smelling clothes, comfortable stuff. Go to MackWeldon.com. Use the promo code MMQB for 20% off. Thanks to our producer, Matt Havia, and editor, Chris Basil, and all the good folks at Digital Media. And as always, thank you so much to our researcher, Jeff Irwin, who makes us sound smart. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast. Honestly, you guys are the best. You make the show happen. Andy and I, we want to hear from you. Send us questions, send us comments, Andy_Benoit or gramling_si on Twitter, or get us on Facebook, or send something to talkback@themmqb.com. We love hearing from you. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including themmqb.com, si.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Monday morning.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.